Hi, I'm Dr. David Feifel. I'm a psychiatrist, neuroscientist, and psychedelic medicine pioneer, and you're listening to Professionally Psychedelics.
Where do they go? The smoke rings I blow each night. Oh,
It gives
what
me
do
great
they
pleasure to
do?
welcome to the
Those
pod for
birds
the first official Professionally Psychedelics episode, Dr. David Feifel, Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego, and the Director of the Kadima Neuropsychiatry Institute. For years, David has been a pioneer working on a number of projects and active applications of psychedelics as a treatment for mental health conditions, and is the perfect person to shed light on how medicines like ketamine are currently being used, paired with the amazing research that is being performed using other compounds, which will no doubt both shape and reconfigure the landscape of mental health treatment. He is an all-round great guy and someone I am delighted to be joining us on the pod. So, without further ado, David, welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to be here. As I was listening to that introduction, I got worried that maybe you had planned for a different guest.
No, David, we're very sure it's you.
Okay. That's good.
And we'd love to ask you, on behalf of all of our listeners, what led you to psychedelic medicines?
What led me to psychedelic medicine was really an attempt to find better treatments for mental illness. That's ultimately how this journey came about. I never envisioned that it would bring me to psychedelics, but during my career, I've really focused on trying to find new treatments, more effective treatments, more options, because very clear to me that mental illness was an incredibly prominent, prevalent, and devastating scourge upon society, and that the treatments we had when I entered the field in the 90s were really not up to the battle. And so I entered my career, trained as both a physician and a neuroscientist, and came to UC San Diego, which was and is a leading center for both clinical care and cutting edge brain research. And for the 20 years that I was on faculty there and became a professor, I was doing research from basic science in my laboratory with little rats to human studies to seeing patients, all with the goal in mind of helping the patients that I saw, but also looking towards the future, trying to find better tools, because I just felt that that we were outgunned by things like depression and anxiety and schizophrenia and OCD and PTSD, et cetera, et cetera. So as part of that, I was always looking on the horizon to see what was coming down the road that might be a game changer. And in 2008, I became very interested in very few studies that had been published on ketamine infusions to treat treatment-resistant depression, and the data were really remarkable. These were small samples of patients, but the data were remarkable, and I thought, well, this could be an artifact, as we often see. Sometimes you get papers published and they just don't pan out; they can't be replicated. I said, so it's either that, or it's going to be one of the biggest breakthroughs in psychiatry in decades. And I felt I had to find out. So I went to the powers that be at the university, which is, as all universities, relatively risk averse. And but I prevailed upon them to let me start a ketamine program for people with treatment resistant depression. And I quickly realized that this is something really special. Something that is not like any of the treatments that we had previously, and it all took off from there. So I started to become I started that that happened to, it turned out that that was the first ketamine treatment for psychiatric illnesses program anywhere in the world, which started in 2008, and then it just took off from there. And I've been pursuing better ways of using ketamine to treat patients ever since. And And then now look, you know, diverging into other compounds like psilocybin, which we are doing studies on right now in under the sponsorship of Compass Pathways, under FDA registration studies. So that's my journey.
A whole heap to unpick there. And one of the things I'd be keen to ask is that you mentioned that sort of entering the field in the 90s, there were really not that many treatments available in the psychiatry field, and quite a lot of them had their shortcomings. Would you be able to give us a sort of whistle-stop tour of traditional medicines that have been used in psychiatry and the type of shortcomings and limitations they have?
Well, you can look at the history of modern psychiatry, I think, as different phases. Probably, you know, the first phase of modern psychiatry starts with Freud and the idea that we could change people's mental state through talk therapy. And Freud was trained as a neurologist, and he understood that mental illness was a product of something going amiss within the brain. but he understood that we had limited tools of fixing that directly. And talk therapy, he understood, was a way of you know, getting at the underlying brain process. And that was really the tool for psychiatry at that point to change people's mental state, to deal with pathological states. And then in the early, late 50s, early 60s, there were drugs that were found to have remarkable effects on people's moods and their state of mind, a lot of times ameliorating conditions that were problematic, like depression. And these were found by serendipity. So, for example, and these are all fascinating stories that I could take you through, but just as an example, the discovery of antidepressants occurred by way of a new anti-tuberculosis medication, one of the first treatments for tuberculosis that was introduced into the market in the 1950s. And taking the listeners back to previous era in the 50s, you know, tuberculosis still was a major epidemic, and people were quarantine, something we're familiar with now in these, you know, what you would call, at least here in the States, they call them sanatoriums. So you'd have these sanatoriums where people with tuberculosis would be housed. And they were pretty miserable places. And they introduced this this drug called iproniazid, which is a precursor of one of the mainstay drugs that we still use today to treat tuberculosis. And there was this interesting thing that not only was it helping with the tuberculosis, but the doctors and the staff noticed that people's moods were greatly improving. And it was actually problematic because some of the inpatients, if you will, who were passive and, you know, very low maintenance, suddenly started to demand activities and things like that. And the staff were like, what is going on? Everyone seems to be frightened. And even some people actually developed mania, which is something we know that an antidepressant can do if a patient has the type of depression that is the bipolar type. So this was very strange, and they started looking at what other features, aside from its effects on tuberculosis, iproniazid has, and they found that it actually affects an enzyme in the brain that breaks down some of the neurotransmitters we call monoamines, and that would include serotonin, which everyone, I think, has heard about with regards to mood, and also dopamine and something called noradrenaline or norepinephrine. And that sort of was sort of the beginning of the era of the what I would call conventional antidepressants. You know, some of the earlier ones were from categories we now call tricyclic antidepressants, monoamine inhibitors. So those were some of the earlier ones. And then later on, they became a little bit more sophisticated, mainly in reducing side effects, and with the advent of the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Prozac being the sort of the iconic prototype for that category. What Prozac did was it made prescribing antidepressants very easy because they had fewer side effects than the older antidepressants, and they didn't require titration because of the decreased side effect profile. They didn't require cardiograms, which some of the earlier antidepressants required because they had potential effects on the heart, and that opened the door to antidepressants being able to be prescribed by primary care doctors, for whom previously it was a little bit daunting to manage the antidepressants without the, you know, the training. And
so previously, was it only specialists that would prescribe them?
Correct. And in fact, when I was a intern in internal medicine, I remember the big marketing campaign for Prozac. It was a picture of a prescription pad, and it had handwriting on it. And you knew it was sort of a marketing product because the handwriting was legible. It wasn't a real doctor's handwriting. It was a clear giveaway, you know. And it said, you know, Prozac, 20 milligrams, one tablet a day. And what it was trying to say was, doctors, this is really an easy way to treat depression. You know, it's just a simple one single pill right away off the bat. You know, you don't have to kind of ease people up into the dose, and you don't have to do any blood work, and you don't have to do any cardiogram. And it just expanded the willingness of people to prescribe antidepressants. And you know that if you don't have the tool to address a problem, you tend not to recognize the problem. So it's sort of the converse of the old saying, if all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail, right? I'm sure you've heard that. Well, this is maybe the converse of that, where if you don't have a hammer, you cannot see the nails. If it's not
I get it.
So what happened was depression, which had largely gone unrecognized, started to become more and more recognized at the general practitioner level. We call them family practitioners or GPs here in the United States. So the treatment of depression started to shift towards the GPs, and many, many, many more people got on the medication because, you know, it became something doable. That's sort of a bit of a diversion from what I think the point I was trying to make was, along the way, the medications, because they were shown to work, inspired a theory that the cause of depression was a chemical imbalance. And the idea was, well, we know that these medications, essentially what they do is increase the levels of serotonin and noradrenaline, sometimes dopamine as well. And it only made sense to think, well, you know, depression, therefore, probably is the result of a deficiency in the brain of those neurotransmitters. And it's a very compelling story that was a theory, a scientific theory for a while, but then quickly became passed over because we couldn't find any evidence that people with depression actually had lower levels of any of these neurochemicals. In fact, there was clear evidence that in multiple ways that people with depression don't have these abnormalities, and that it's not the simple raising of these levels that causes antidepressants to work. However, the pharmaceutical industry globbed onto that nice narrative and I think pushed that narrative in a lot of commercials. There's a very famous Zoloft commercial that kind of has this little, here in the States, it has a Zoloft being sertraline. It's another member. It was the next SSRI that came on the market after Prozac, and had a little, you know, a little animation of two nerve endings with the neurotransmitters, you know, passing between them. And in somebody with depression, you know, very few neurotransmitters. And then on the Zoloft, the level of neurotransmitters moving back and forth increased. So I think that, you know, as human beings, and I deal with this all the time with my patients and sometimes sadly with my colleagues, our brains really want to understand the world, and they really gravitate towards a nice handy story that makes sense to us, that lets us feel kind of okay, we, you know, this is the answer to this. And so the idea that depression was a biochemical imbalance, or even more simply a deficiency in the monoamines, which was called the monoamine hypothesis, just stuck. And to this day, I have a lot of patients who come in are shocked to hear that, you know, low serotonin has nothing to do with depression. And we can drop a normal person's serotonin very quickly. We have ways of doing that just by having them actually take a certain drink with certain large neutral amino acids. It'll pull the serotonin out of their brain, and they don't become depressed. And likewise, we know that people who take these SSRIs, their serotonin levels go up very quickly, within hours, a day or so at the most, but their therapeutic response doesn't follow that time course. It takes weeks. So there's globs of evidence that the you know, the simplistic brain chemistry abnormality is answer is not really the cause. Getting back to, I think, the question of, you know,
well, I almost want to butt in there and say, do you have a hypothesis you prefer currently?
Well, I think that we recognize that the antidepressants set off a chain of responses in the brain to compensate for them. So they do raise serotonin. They do, depending on the specific compound, they do raise noradrenaline. And then the brain reacts to that. And one of the ways it reacts, for example, is it starts to reduce the number of receptors on the nerve cells, which are sort of the docking ports for those neurotransmitters. So that since there's more, there's more ships coming towards the shore, you know, the nerve cells sort of reduce the number of docks that are open so that they're not overwhelmed by all these ships trying to dock on the shores. And that's a time course that's closer to when people start to feel better. But the reality is we don't know. And that's sometimes hard for people in the profession to say and for people to recognize. But the truth is we came about these drugs, and then it also includes the antipsychotics. You know, the antipsychotics were found by a surgeon in France who was looking at lowering temperature in his patients postoperatively and found that, you know, it reduced the delirium, the psychotic delirium that people experienced as they were coming out of anesthetics. And he told it to a couple of his psychiatrist buddies, and they started giving it to people in their psychiatric inpatient wards. And, you know, the first antipsychotic was born. That was Thorazine. So we came about these medications really by serendipity, by noticing something happening with other drugs. And we still haven't figured out exactly how they do what they do, but it just goes to show you that in medicine, you can have effective treatments without really totally understanding how they work. And I think that's where we are, honestly, for most of our treatments. The brain, I chose a specialty where unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, the organ, organ of interest, the brain, is so incredibly complex that it's going to take a long time to really reverse engineer it and figure out exactly what's going on. You got 85 billion brain cells, each of which have thousands of connections to each other. And so when information engineers kind of like did the calculations, they recognize that there's more computing power in our brains than there are in the most advanced supercomputer that we have today. So sometimes you just say we don't know. We know some things and we can rule out some things, but we just don't know. Answer, maybe.
well, I think it's an honest answer, which you have to have a weight of knowledge and understanding behind you to be open about and say. But I guess I wanted to transfer it, calling back to Jonathan's question that set us off down this lane. Do we know how ketamine, for instance, works on the brain comparatively to, say, your SSRIs? And do we have a model for what it's doing for depression there?
So that's a great question. I think that's a great segue into ketamine. So, and the answer, like I think with the other things, is that yes, we do know some things we do have some knowledge, but we fall short when we try to pin its effects onto one or other of these. So when we talk about ketamine, for example, comparing it to the antidepressants that I talked about previously. And by the way, before we move off that topic, I should say that the issue is, with these conventional antidepressants, and we have so many of them, the issue is that they can help a lot of people with depression. But for many people, and for too large a proportion of people with depression, they either do not improve their depression, or they improve their depression in a very unsatisfactory way, meaning they might help a little bit, but still leave them quite debilitated. And or they have side effects that prevent their, you know, being fully utilized. And so on the whole, they leave a large proportion of people with clinical depression, and they're also used for anxiety. So we conclude anxiety in that. With a disease for which there isn't satisfactory reduction of symptoms. And a lot of the patients that come to see me have stopped taking them because they've been on 4, 5, 6. And while we have many antidepressants, they don't differ enough from each other. They all target that same small group of neurotransmitters that represent less than 1% of the neurochemical signals communicating between brain cells in the brain. So that lets me go back to ketamine. Now, ketamine, we know, is a drug that regulates a different neurochemical signal in the brain called glutamate. And glutamate happens to be the most ubiquitous, or at least one of two most ubiquitous neurochemicals in the brain. And it's all over the more evolutionarily recent part of our brains, the cortex, which does all the kind of the deep thinking and is what separates us from other species, but also causes us to be more predisposed to mental disorders. So it binds to glutamate, so not to serotonin receptors, not to the noradrenaline receptors, not to the dopamine receptors, and it actually binds to a specific type of the glutamate receptors. And what it does is it kind of blocks natural glutamate from binding to that receptor. So it acts as what we call an antagonist. An antagonist is something that takes up the parking space, but doesn't actually, I liken it to, if you had a store and you had just a few parking spaces for your customers. And then if somebody drove up and took one of those parking spaces, but never, they end up talking on their phone, never came in, they reduce the ability of your store to do business because you're not coming in and giving them business, and you're preventing somebody from taking that parking space who might otherwise want to come in and do business. So ketamine blocks that receptor so that glutamate in the brain can't access that receptor and do what it normally does on that brain cell. So that's sort of at the level of the most basic entry level of what does glutamate do? What does ketamine do that differs from the other drugs? But then after we go from there, it gets very complicated. It gets metabolized into other subchemicals of ketamine that bind to other versions of the glutamate and so on and so forth. So if we look at the receptor level, there's a difference. We can then think about, well, what does it do to brain activity? We can ask the question about how ketamine differs from other, psychiatric drugs. At that level, not sort of at the cellular level, but at the overall brain activity. We have good ways of measuring brain activity now with scans and so forth. One of the interesting things that ketamine does is it does something that's very similar to what the other psychedelics do, like LSD and psilocybin. And this is why we think that its mechanism may be more in common with those other agents. What it does is it shuts down a kind of a information pathway in the brain called the default mode network. The default mode network is this circuit in the brain that involves different areas in different regions that tend to kind of get active when we are sort of not engaged in any type of mental task that requires, deep concentration. So normally if we are studying something visually intensely, our visual areas is dominates, and if we're listening to this podcast and trying to decipher what's being said, it's our auditory areas on the sides, both sides of our brains, connected to the language areas that decipher sound, turn into meaning. But when we're kind of not doing anything too intensely, what we used to think that, well, the brain is just kind of just in neutral and kind of shut down when we're not doing anything. But it turns out that we discovered that that's not the case, that in those states of mind, the default node network kind of comes to life. And we think that the default node network plays an important role in psychological continuity, where we each of us sort of have the sense that we are one entity, and the hand that we see to our right and the hand that we see to our left, the thoughts that we have inside, all part of one package with a boundary that separates us from the rest of the world. So we think that default mode network plays a role in keeping the idea of a coherent person. And when people take ketamine or LSD and psilocybin and a lot of other drugs that produce what we call the psychedelic experience, the default node network tends to kind of go away, you know, or not, you know, we can't see it active as a coherent circuit. And instead, there's this almost chaotic global increase in activity in all the brain areas, which you don't normally see because it doesn't represent one type of activity or another. So suddenly the brain lights up, all the areas light up. And the thinking is that that corresponds with the experience that a lot of people will have in the psychedelic state where they feel very connected to the universe and to other people and so forth. There isn't this sort of sense of separation. We think that that global pluralistic, if you will, activity might be what's causing that sensation. And I've heard it likened to the idea is, imagine if all the in the UK, do you call them freeways or highways?
Motorways.
Okay.
M1.
So imagine M1 and all the other motorways had to be shut down for repairs at the same time. It would cause major disturbance in people's ability to get around, and suddenly people would have to be forced to take all these we call them surface streets. All the roads through the neighborhoods. On your way to work, you would realize that there's a lot of neighborhoods next to the ones that you live in that you never got to know because you passed over them on the motorway. Now you're driving through them, and you feel you feel like you're more connected to your larger community. So ketamine, we know produces a difference at the cellular level with the receptors that it binds to and what it how it changes firing activity and what neurotransmitters it will affect. It has differences if we look at activity of the brain, which is next level up. And then psychologically, of course, which I think is the most interesting, is another set of differences. And this is where I think this kind of medicine really differs. And depending on your kind of tendency as a doctor or a provider or a healer, you either find this incredibly attractive as a practice or incredibly frustrating because it's not tight and scientific and fitting in the traditional paradigm of medicine. So what I mean by this is the current paradigm in medicine is, if you take a medicine, Oscar, for example, you're taking a molecule. In that pill is a molecule that's been designed to do something, to interact with the molecules in the tissues of your body, whatever sort of organ we are targeting. And you're just a passive vehicle. Your job is to put that molecule, that tablet, in your body. So doctor prescribes an antibiotic for you, and he says take it once a day. You can take it whenever you want, you can take it before going to bed. So, you pop the pill, you go to bed, you go to sleep. And the idea is while you're asleep, it's being absorbed into your blood and it's seeking out those bacteria and it's destroying them. It's the Terminator. And you're like, you're often, pleasantly dreaming about your last vacation, unawares of what's going on inside your body because your state of mind doesn't matter. This is happening at a material level. And you're not really much of a player except getting it inside your body. In fact, a person could be in a coma and they can develop a blood infection. Doctors can give them intravenous antibiotics, and the infection go away, the bacteria levels go down, and their fever goes away. They can wake up a month later from that coma. Never knew they had the infection. Never knew they had the antibiotics. Never knew it was cured. And that's sort of traditional medicine, Western medicine, the paradigm. Now enter ketamine and psychedelics. This is a little bit controversial in terms of how important this is, but there's a general recognition that now a person's state of mind, their consciousness plays a role in the outcome, and so we can't just overlook it and say, just take this, pill whenever you want. You can take it and go right to bed. Now we need that person to experience the subjective changes that are going to occur in the hour or hours, depending on the drug, after they take the medication. And that changes things because now the patient's consciousness, their state of mind, and therefore the setting, because the setting affects their state of mind, plays a role. So now it's not just a matter of knowing the drug and the dose and being able to write it you know, write the prescription. Now you have to manage the, we call the, I'm sure you're very familiar with the concept of set and setting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really fascinating, right? Because in a way, it brings psychiatry back, it merges the two previous paradigms that dominated at different times, the psychotherapeutic one, where basically you were trying to change the person's state of mind by interacting with them as one human being to another and saying things that had meaning to them and change their mind. And then the biological revolution that occurred starting in the 60s, where it was like, oh, you know, that got underplayed, and it was more about knowing how the brain works and going in there and fixing it, you know, like a mechanic, except through more, you know, biological molecular tools. And now you've got these things that are coming together where there's drugs, and they produce changes in the brain, which we have to know about in order to optimize. We have to figure out what are the parts of that, those changes that, you know, are really critical to the therapeutic effects, and which parts are not, and which parts may be actually, you know, contrary to it. But then there's also the person's state of mind being changed that has to happen, we think, to some extent, that plays in the therapeutic role. So that's fascinating. The analogy, when I have a new patient and I'm trying to explain all this to them, I'll give them this analogy that if they were walking in the mall, I don't know how much walking in the mall we do these days.
in the olden times, when they were allowed.
Yes, back in the day. Daddy, tell me what a mall was. Tell us again what a mall was. People used to actually walk in large crowds. Actually, I think it's probably still going on without much change. But if I went up to, okay, Jonathan, you're walking around the mall and you've got a can of what's your favorite? We won't say beer. What kind of soda do you like? What kind of drinks do you drink?
I'm a big juice man. I'd go with a mango juice or maybe a sparkling lychee if I was really being bougie.
Okay. Well, let's say you had your cup of juice, and I sneak up behind you with a dose of ketamine in my hand, and before you take a sip of your mango juice, I drop the ketamine in your down your straw, and I'm very dexterous and able to do that, and you take a big swig of the juice, and in a few minutes you start to feel funny, and these things start to look different, and you don't know what's going on, and then it becomes very intense, and you become very uncomfortable and feel a little embarrassed because you find that you're not in control of your mind, and you're in a situation where you don't want to make a fool of yourself. And anyway, you know, you have this experience, and you think you're losing your mind, and it's horrifying. And you just find a quiet place and sit it out. And when it's over, you look at it as a horrible experience because you didn't know where that came from. It was unexpected. The setting was terrible. It was you're not conducive to it. You know, and people were walking by, and people were asking you, you know, where this is and where that is. And it was the last thing you want to do is interact with them. And it was just a miserable experience. And whatever happened, you never want to do it again. Now you come to our clinic, and you are coming with the intention of having this experience with the expectation that it's gonna make you better. You know, it's gonna improve your depression symptoms and improve your quality of life. And you're placed in a room that makes you feel very comfortable, and you've got music that you're listening to and noise canceling headphones, and the staff are very sort of empathetic and make you feel very comfortable. And we tell you what we're gonna do, and we talk about the dose that we're gonna give today, you know, compared to the last time, or if it's your first time, what dose we're going to give and what's going to happen. And it all plays out as it does. And you're sort of waiting for it and expecting it. And it turns out that same dose, the same drug that was that could have been a horrible experience that you never want to repeat, would very likely be an experience where you would say, that was phenomenal. That was incredible. That was, I've never experienced anything like that. I can't wait to, you know, to do step two in the treatment. So same drug, same dose. What's the difference? You know, it was a person's state of mind and the setting, the intention they had, the expectation is, and that's wonderful. You know, that's, I think that's so cool. A lot of people go into medicine, like, that's a lot. I mean, I just want to know that if I'm going to, if I'm going to give this drug, it's going to, you know, 85% of people is going to do this, and doesn't matter if they're standing on one leg or they're taking it in the morning or, you know, whatever it is. So that opens up all kinds of messy factors that for some people is not appealing at all. But I think if you find the mind and consciousness and humanity super interesting, it's a great challenge.
What I'm taking from this is that I probably should avoid going on shopping trips with you, David. But
yeah, that's probably too much knowledge and access to mind altering drugs. And I enjoy pranks too much, so it would be not wise.
Shopping trips aside, though, I do find it particularly fascinating, and I think the part that you mentioned about how some clinicians might find it uncomfortable because, you know, it's not so binary as traditional medicines. Well, I think that's just sort of the way of the world and our understanding of the world now, where things in general, not just medicines, lots of things aren't so binary, aren't so black and white. And I think it's really fascinating as a treatment. But sort of building from that, what type of patients and what type of people would you say are best suited to this type of medicine and this type of therapy? I know sort of anecdotally, you know, folks that have OCD sort of enhanced or enforced anxiety can benefit pretty well from ketamine therapy. Sort of, you know, that dissociative state sort of helps them tap into certain areas and break the sort of obsessive cycles. But what other types of people and patients could really benefit from ketamine therapy and other psychedelic compounds that you have sort of worked with and have been involved in research projects on?
Well, we have by far the most experience and knowledge with ketamine because, you know, it is, you know, really the, for all intents and purposes, practically the only legally prescribable psychedelic currently available. So
it's schedule three, if I'm right in saying,
it's
right?
Schedule three, yes, yeah. in the U.S., which means it's a controlled substance, but recognized to be approved for human use because it was approved as an anesthetic back in 1970. So the way the health system is in the United States, and I think to some extent in the UK, but I think there's a little bit more restrictions on doctors there, is that once something is approved for one indication or condition, a doctor can give it for any other condition that they feel, you know, the patient may benefit from, and that's called off-label prescribing, completely legal and quite common. And sometimes the best medicine, the best practice, because, you know, getting FDA approval or having a drug that's approved by the FDA for a certain condition is not what people think. It's not just the sort of the stamp of, you know, this is safe and effective by the FDA because it requires the FDA doesn't go around proactively and look for things to give its approval to. You have to apply to the FDA for a new drug that's never been in human use to get its first indication, or for one that's already approved to get another indication. And that costs globs and globs of money, hundreds of millions of dollars to go through those hoops and to do the studies the way the FDA wants those studies done. So there are a lot of drugs that are recognized from to have good scientific evidence from studies that didn't go through the kind of procedures of FDA, you know, regulatory requirements, but are considered to be very solid, scientifically performed studies that show that a drug is effective and safe for a certain condition, that it's not approved, and it will never get approved because there isn't that economic incentive. So with ketamine, it's a great example of something that we know, but at this point, is very effective, and I think by now the data are it's been out long enough that we also recognize it's quite safe under, you know, medical supervision, but we'll probably never get FDA approval because it's an old drug, and getting a patent at this point on ketamine for depression is pretty much impossible without some sort of novel twist, and so there's no business incentive for any pharmaceutical company to get, you know, 50-year-old ketamine approved by the FDA, because the moment that they did get the approval from the FDA, having spent those hundreds of million dollars, any other pharmaceutical company could apply to the FDA to market that drug generically, as long as and all they would have to do is show that their formulation of the drug produced comparable blood levels of ketamine as the brand, the original company's version of it. And then even there's a 20% leeway given by the FDA there, so they'd only have to get within 80 to 120% of the blood levels, you know, that that the original approval. So it's not going to happen, and it's not going to happen just purely because of the structure of the patent system and the FDA. And the implication for that is that because ketamine is not approved for anything other than as an anesthetic, it's not approved for depression, that insurance companies in the United States aren't covering it, because but as a general rule, the first hurdle for them to cover a treatment is FDA approval. So you see, you've got this kind of like conundrum here of a drug that everyone at this point recognizes is, you know, a breakthrough. It's probably, the biggest breakthrough in 50 years in psychiatry. And there's lots of great studies from all kinds of great universities and great scientists, including myself. I'll throw myself into that august group. We published the very first we call naturalistic study of ketamine treatment. People who are just coming in and getting treated in our clinic, not signing up for a research study, and therefore being selected, to be kind of a purified sample without medical issues or suicidal issues. And we published that and showed that, after one single treatment, 52%, I think, of the patients, met the criteria, the standard criteria of a response, which means that their symptoms of depression went down by at least 50%. That's 24 hours after the first treatment.
Please take me above. Take me with you.